You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of February 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here at Monocle 24. I'm Tyler Burley. On today's show...
Very soon after the fall of the Berlin Wall, we walked through Hyde Park looking for Speaker's Corner, which, especially for us East Germans, was legendary, the very symbol of free speech.
How cozy. German Chancellor Angela Merkel reminisces about her time in the British capital during an historic address at the Palace of Westminster. Joining me to unpick the speech and many more of the day's top stories are Brett Mason and Xenia Dormandy. Also ahead, we'll discuss U.S. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel's vision for the size and scope of the U.S. military, which he outlined in an address on Monday.
Defense spending is not expected to reach the levels projected in the five-year budget plan submitted by the President last year. Given these realities, we must now adapt, innovate, and make difficult decisions to ensure that our military remains ready and capable.
We'll discuss the remarks which continue to divide opinion, both at home and abroad. And before the end of the program, we'll check in on the comings and goings in Istanbul and review some of the titles atop the bestseller list in Italy. Right here in Midori House, live from London with me, Tyler Brûlé. Now we're going to try to soldier through the next 59 minutes or so of this program. It was our 7th anniversary due with our big clients last night. Everyone's a little bit foggy-headed upstairs, behind the controls, and elsewhere. Hopefully, though, not our newsreader, Paul Osborne, here with the World Headlines.
Monocle 24 News. Ukraine's interim government has warned Russia to avoid any acts of aggression in Crimea. Armed men earlier seized the regional parliament in the only part of Ukraine with a majority Russian population. Meanwhile, Russia is continuing military exercises close to the border with Ukraine. NATO's Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen is appealing for calm on all sides.
I urge all parties to step back from confrontation, refrain from provocative actions, and return to the path of dialogue.
Russia says it's accepted a request for protection from the ousted Ukrainian president, Viktor Yanukovych. Ukrainian officials are warning Russian troops not to leave the Black Sea Fleet's base in Sevastopol. The British Prime Minister, David Cameron, says it's vital the people of Ukraine are free to make their own decisions about their future.
We are particularly concerned by the situation in Crimea. Every country should respect the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine. Russia has made that commitment, and it's important that Russia keeps its word. The world will be watching.
Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel has said she wants to work with Britain to reform the way the European Union works, but has warned it won't be easy. She was speaking after talks in London with David Cameron. He has said he wants significant changes to the EU and plans to hold a referendum in Britain in 2017 on whether the country should remain a member. At least 31 people are believed to have been killed in a series of bomb attacks in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. 17 were killed in one explosion at a market. Another bomb attached to a minibus killed 5 people, and more than 50 others are thought to have been injured across the city. Last year saw the highest number of deaths in Iraq for 6 years, almost 9,000. Protests have been staged today in cities across the world demanding the release of 9 journalists from the Al Jazeera network who are being detained in Egypt. They went on trial last week accused of aiding a terrorist organization, the Muslim Brotherhood, which was banned by Egypt's military rulers after they overthrew the president, Mohamed Morsi. The 8 are among a total of 20 who face what Al Jazeera has called absurd, baseless and false allegations. Islamist militants have been blamed for attacks in the northeast of Nigeria, in which at least 28 people are thought to have been killed. Shops, houses and banks were looted and burned in a 6-hour raid by Boko Haram, according to witnesses in Adamawa State. The attack comes as the French president joined African leaders at a conference on security in Nigeria's capital, Abuja. The head of the US Federal Reserve has admitted that recent appalling weather may have weakened the economy. Temperatures plunged far below freezing in many parts of the US. Thousands of flights were cancelled. Fewer than 200,000 jobs were added in the last 2 months, far below expectations. And Janet Yellen says the weather may be to blame.
A number of data releases have pointed to softer spending than many analysts had expected. Part of that softness may reflect adverse weather conditions, but at this point it's difficult to discern exactly how much.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Paul. More from you in about 25 minutes' time. You're listening to Midori House. It is just 7:05 in the morning. If you're listening in Auckland, it's 18:05 here in London. We're back in a moment.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦，这是 Monocle 24.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Joining me now, certainly for the first half of the program, they can stay around a little bit longer if they want, of course, is Xenia Dormandy, Project Director for Chatham House's US program. And also Brett Mason is here, Europe correspondent for one of my favorite networks, SBS World out of Australia. Hello and welcome.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Brett, what's been keeping you busy? What's keeping an Aussie correspondent on their toes in London at the moment?
Oh, look, it's been a very busy time. I've just off the plane from Cairo. I've been over there covering the plight of a fellow correspondent who has found himself locked behind bars in an Egyptian prison. So that's been certainly keeping me very busy for the last few weeks.
And I would imagine there's been a lot of reflection, certainly, on Mr. Chuck Hagel's announcements this week, Xenia, or not.
No, there has, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, there's such an interesting battle that's going to be just as partisan as so many others in Washington over the budget, particularly the defense budget. Mm. I mean, it's fascinating. You can almost predict what's going to happen next.
Just before we launch into this, for those who may have not seen the story, not spent time in Australia, where does SBS's news agenda sit? Because it's fascinating if you're in Australia, any given morning of a weekday, and your network is running all of the various newscasts in of course, various languages from many of the public service broadcasters around the world. But in terms of then your own news gathering, how does SBS differentiate itself compared to if I was watching Nine, or certainly if I was watching the ABC?
Look, we're a very unique broadcaster, and it's a great organization to work for. We're actually the world's largest multilingual broadcaster. All of our programs are in 74 languages, which is more than the BBC. And as a foreign correspondent, having worked for a commercial network, I was always looking for stories about Australians overseas doing things involving Australians, whereas now I just tell amazing international stories without even finding an Australian in the crowd. So our charter is really about going to those places where no one else is going and telling stories for people who don't speak English as their first language, who might not have this implied knowledge. And we're really proud of that. And since joining SBS, I've discovered that it's a very, very important service we provide to a lot of Australians who simply can't consume the mainstream media because they don't have a knowledge or an interest in the types of stories they're covering.
It's a curious concept because to take a channel like yours global and play it back to the rest of the world would seem rather odd, but I'd always start with there's a huge opportunity, and you come back to London or you're anywhere else, you go, I wish I had a little bit of SBS World. maybe someone's listening in Sydney or Canberra or wherever those checks are written. Let's begin the program with German Chancellor Angela Merkel's address to the British Parliament today. She joins an exclusive group of leaders who, of course, have addressed Parliament following the steps of Nelson Mandela, the Dalai Lama, President Obama. Merkel's speech, of course, comes at a time of growing unease within Britain's Conservative-led government on the UK's membership of the European Union et al. This is how Chancellor Merkel outlined the UK's future role in the EU.
Some expect my speech to pave the way for a fundamental reform of the European architecture, which will satisfy all kinds of alleged or actual British wishes. I'm afraid they are in for a disappointment.
Now, in a joint press conference following the address, British Prime Minister David Cameron reasserted his government's belief that the UK's place is in Europe and the EU's role itself should be reviewed.
I want Britain to be a positive player in a reformed European Union. And I know that Angela wants a strong Britain in that reformed European Union. My objective is clear. I want to be able to say to the British people in the referendum that will take place by the end of 2017 that we've sufficiently reformed the European Union that they should vote to remain in it. But be in no doubt, it will be an in-out referendum.
Well, let's talk about all those things that came out of Parliament. I think one of the most amazing things, I've actually never heard Angela Merkel ever speak English. No matter where she is, whether she's in D.C. Or she's she pops up somewhere else in the world, she's obviously always addressing the German media first and foremost. And so you're always hearing her fine East German accent. So that was the biggest revelation so far. But how did you read this?
You make an interesting point. You know, why was she speaking English? She doesn't do this. Well, she was doing it because she was making and trying to direct her comments to a British audience. Mm. I mean, what screams out of this, the mere fact that she gave a talk to Parliament tells you how close the relationship is between Merkel and Cameron, and how much they're going to try and work to find a solution that keeps the UK in the EU. And she was going as far forward as she possibly could, I think. And the speaking English is a significant part of that.
Mm. And as a role model, Tante Angela, it's always curious to see not just how. The UK press, of course, just portrays Germany in general, but also having a little bit of fun with her. But do you think, if you're the British public, is there a certain warmth to her? And I think, how did you sort of read the performance today? I mean, obviously, this is going to be dissected on news programs over the next 3 or 4 hours here in London. But what was your take on it?
If you read the reporting on it, it's fairly factual. It doesn't go in a lot of detail on the, as you say, Tante Merkel, which I think is an interesting way to look at her. Not quite the way I have in the past, but nevertheless, it's an interesting way to look at her. But I think that there's a lot of really interesting stuff coming out of Germany at the moment. The Munich Security Conference back at the beginning of this month, the German president kind of put forward this idea that we're going to see a new kind of German foreign policy that's going to be not more interventionist, but more engaged. And so I think there are a lot of questions. There are a lot in Europe who are kind of looking at this and saying, is it real? Is it just rhetoric? What does it mean? What can we expect? As Mrs. Merkel said, I'm not going to give you the answers you want. There are no black and whites.
Yeah.
This is about a process. This is about a conversation. But let's have that conversation, which I personally think that's a very positive way forward. They're feeling their way, so are we.
Brett, how did you read it?
Well, we certainly wanted to make her feel very welcome, didn't we? She had a cup of tea with the Queen at Buckingham Palace. She spoke at Parliament, a very rare honour for someone who isn't a head of state. We must remember that she isn't a head of state, so a very rare honour. The couch conversation inside Number 10 with the Prime Minister, keen to sort of present it, looking at it from a PR perspective, keen to present a very warm relationship there. But interestingly, domestically, I think it sends a signal internally here in Britain just how important David Cameron sees the assistance that the Chancellor can offer him to please the rest of the EU. He wants those reforms. He's effectively pledged those reforms, but he also knows he can't deliver on those reforms without the help of people like the Chancellor. So a very, from his perspective, I guess, a neutral result. I don't think he's necessarily, she hasn't said anything beyond a basic pledge. But she also hasn't exactly said that she's not prepared to back those reforms. She said, we'll work with you. It won't be easy. So she sort of, walked a very fine line very well today. Mm. She hasn't offended anyone and she hasn't promised anyone anything at the same time.
A true diplomat.
Well,
Brett, as a foreign correspondent based in London, how do you view the relationship? And maybe, not that you can speak on behalf of your Commonwealth cousins here, but is Germany the most acceptable face, sort of the best benchmark that Cameron can try to direct the nation's gaze to, do you think?
Well, I think everyone realizes that Germany is the biggest player in the EU at the moment. It certainly seems to be financially sound. It seems to be dominating on the political scene. The Chancellor clearly dominates on the world stage as much as people make fun of her, and she's presented as this sort of character. So I think, people definitely recognise that. And I think that, Australians, whether we like it or not, I don't think people have a really strong opinion about Germany. But certainly, I think if you said to Australians, name the last three chancellors of Germany, they probably couldn't, but they could all name the current one.
Mm.
I don't know. I mean, I find it interesting. If I look at it from an American hat for a second, yes, America, you know, I mean, America has been longing for Europe to be Europe, to have a European policy, and has strongly supported Ashton again and again and again in having one voice. But at the same time, it's recognized that actually the member states each continue to have a voice and each continue to have a foreign policy. Germany has a very important role. But actually, if you think about it in the security realm, France increasingly also has a really, really important role. Now, of course, Sarkozy, Hollande was here not so long ago, did not get anything like this kind of reception. And so, I mean, I think there's a interpretation taking place in Europe, which is actually quite different from the one taking place in the United States, which is perhaps a little bit more nuanced and isn't putting all of this pressure on Germany, except in the economic space.
Mm. We're going to take a short break. I want to pick up on this security topic, as we'll be talking about, of course, Chuck Hagel's announcement, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, those announcements on Monday when we come back from this very short break. Stay with us.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. My guests for this first half hour, or next 15 minutes, Zainia Dormady, Project Director for Chatham House's US program, and Brett Mason, Europe correspondent for SBS World News out of Australia. Now, I mentioned, or you were touching on the topic of security in Hollande just before the break. As we're saying at the top of the show, US Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel outlined his vision for the future of the US military at the start of the week. Among, I guess, some of the more contentious topics of the Secretary of Defense's remarks were his assertion that the U.S. should have a smaller military, something closer in size to that of the years leading up to the Second World War. This is some of what Secretary Hagel had to say on Monday.
As I weighed these recommendations, I have, as I often do, looked to the pages of American history for guidance. In doing so, an admonition by Henry Stimson stood up. Writing after World War II, Roosevelt's Secretary of War during that time said that Americans must act in the world as it is and not in the world as we wish it were. Stimson knew that America's security at home depended on sustaining our commitments abroad and investing in a strong national defense. He was a realist. This is a time for reality. This is a budget that recognizes the reality of the magnitude of our fiscal challenges, the dangerous world we live in, and the American military's unique and indispensable role in the security of this country and in today's volatile world. There are difficult decisions ahead. That is the reality we're living with.
Zainia Dormady, where do you start with that? I guess the first thing is, you know, at least you didn't reach for the Bible for references. But if you were also the director of public affairs, at least for Mr. Hagel's office, would you have been reaching for the history book? And is anyone feeling particularly good about this? You know, and that is opposite side of the Pacific, this side of the Atlantic, and certainly in and around D.C.
I think it's probably smart on his part to reach from history, because actually, if you look at history, you look at budget numbers, you look at personnel numbers, America's military is so much bigger than it has been historically. And yet, if you look at the threats that we face, they're far more diverse, but they're fundamentally of a different nature. And I think that kind of looking back to history, it's a very dangerous approach to take. But at the same time, you can actually make some comments. You know, do we really look at where we were post-Cold War, where we are today? Do we really need that? Do we really need that that kind of configuration? What I think is really interesting from what he's announced, I mean, a couple of points. One, what is really interesting from what he's announced is that he's made cuts principally in the army, but also in some of the in terms of some of the equipment for the Navy and for the Air Force in particular. But he's made it before there's kind of a public affirmed budget, before the Congress has really come down. I mean, he's really going to piss off some of Congress, and you've already begun to see that. Excuse me, but I mean that's what's happening. He's talking about base closures, which, of course, Congress fights all the way. What is the bottom line of this that is perhaps the thing we should remember is almost every single senior military American officer that I talk with say we can make these kind of cuts. And when I say these kind of cuts, we're talking $1 trillion US dollars over a period of 10 years. We can make those kind of cuts without actually affecting American security if we can choose where to make the cuts. And the trouble is Congress will not allow the Pentagon or the military to choose where to make those cuts. And again, you're already, he was trying to get out in front saying this is what needs to be done before Congress can come and stab him in the back.
And base closures aside, also some pretty high profile programs, either iced or certainly cut as well. So what that's also going to mean for, of course, you know, various constituencies is jobs.
It's absolutely jobs. And again, this is where you see it again and again and again, where Congress pushes back is so often not about actually what kind of security does America need, because Congress is saying one thing that the army doesn't, the military does not agree with. This is about jobs. This is about base closures. This is about political issues for Congress.
Brett, do you think everyone in Canberra, and certainly one can sort of look at, there's been a bit of a spending spree in Australia at the moment, but also financial realities also sitting in, you know, very, very close ally on the other side of the Pacific. Were people not comforted, but realizing, yeah, this is just the reality of today. There are going to be cuts. Everything should be fine.
Well, we've seen cuts here in the UK as well. And the most convenient thing about talking about history when it comes to these cuts is you don't have to talk about modern history. And that is that the US has spent a lot of money fighting some very expensive modern wars over the last, say, 15 years. And that's the reality of the situation. They've spent a lot of money. And yes, politically, of course, legislators are going to be very unhappy about these base closures, people losing their jobs. American people will. But that being said, too, people are really fatigued with this defense buildup, this massive expenditure, hundreds of billions of dollars a year. I mean, America spends six, seven, eight times more on their defense budget than some of its, a lot more. And, you know, I guess most Australians would be staggered by the amount of spending. I don't think we particularly worry, you know, about what America and the UK are doing. We've seen, as you say, we've spent some money on projects and some infrastructure recently, but, you know, like the UK, we're looking at boosting our reservist forces as opposed to our commissioned officers, our full-time staff. And I don't think people worry about that in Australia. I think we worry for the people who are affected by these cuts, but I think people would be happy to see those budget savings reducing, you know, the cost to the regular American households.
I think one of the most controversial parts, but one of the most important parts, is going to be in the personnel costs. If you look at the American defense budget, increasingly a third to a half to two-thirds is on personnel costs. It's not equipment, it's not bases, it's personnel, it's healthcare, it's pensions, it's training, it's those kind of things. And Secretary Hagel is trying to cut there. And that's where it suddenly gets personal.
Yes,
extremely personal.
But it's also where if America is going to control its defense budget, where those cuts really have to take place. So it's going to be interesting to see whether he can maneuver around that very personal, very kind of gut-wrenching, can we give our soldiers who are putting their lives on the line less than we did yesterday?
Just before we move on to talk about your trip out to Egypt recently, do you think we'll also see a rethink? And I think you raised such an interesting point, Zay, about just, you know, the true personnel costs. And then you have to think about personnel costs, because then you're also talking about spouses, partners, families, you know, all of that, which is bundled into that. And just as you know, we've seen a great change in journalism. It's not sort of the days. I don't imagine, Brett, when they moved, you heard that they sent your grand piano with you and seven containers when you washed up on these shores. So it certainly changed for the role of journalists. Do you think we also enter a phase, well, where there's going to be a real rethink also in what global deployment looks like as well, Zenia?
I think, I mean, it's a fascinating question. I mean, it's a hugely controversial question. We've been doing a lot of work on Asian Pacific security in the world for the US. And one of the questions we're asking, which is enormously controversial, is, you know, America still has 60 to 70,000 troops sitting particularly in Japan and in South Korea.
Well, I was thinking about Okinawa right away, just exactly. When you see, yeah, all of the housing, yet, everything that goes with it.
Exactly. And do we need that? Mm. Are we going to be in a ground war? And the answer that almost anybody you ask is the probability of ground war is slim to nothing. And if we do have a ground war, it's going to come after an economic war, a cyber war, a space war, an air war, a maritime war. I mean, it's the last thing on the list. And so does one need that kind of troops? I mean, we're using drones more, we're using technology more. I think if you can flit forward 50 years, the world looks very, very different in the military, as it does everywhere else. But can we make those changes? That's very, very hard to do.
Yeah, 2 points. I agree with you. The number of troops is becoming less because the technology allows us to do more,
so much more.
Without them. And the second thing is, when you sign up a soldier, you can't budget for what might happen. Look at the troops in Afghanistan who have now suffered post-traumatic stress, who we will be supporting, and rightly so, for the rest of their lives. And that's an ongoing, you can't potentially budget and know what kind of expenditure. So it's to an extent an open book, that commitment that you make to those soldiers.
Brett, I wanted you to take us to Cairo right now. 20 journalists from Al Jazeera's news network currently on trial in Egypt. Of course, you know, focus of attention for broadcasters and news outlets around the world. Today, staff in the organization channels held a day of solidarity with their colleagues who remain, of course, behind bars in Cairo. You've just come back doing a report for SBS. I'm wondering, maybe we've got a small clip here, and I'm wondering if you perhaps want to set that up for us first.
Yeah, well, effectively, Peter Grester, who's an award-winning correspondent for Al Jazeera. He worked for the BBC and CNN beforehand and had in fact filed reports for my program, SBS Dateline. We followed his brother Andrew, his younger brother, who's a cotton farmer from regional New South Wales, who's never been to Cairo, who flew over there to try and help his brother. So we spent a week with him visiting his brother and going to court with him. So we'll take a listen to the clip now.
He's only allowed out 1 hour a day. He's in the cell with his two other colleagues. There's a couple of tanks, guys with guns everywhere, and he reassured me that he's holding up, you know, emotionally, physically, mentally, they're doing fine. You know, they'll come out of this as they went in.
It was Andrew Grester there speaking about, of course, his brother in captivity, Peter Grester. First, I just want to go to the commissioning of this story from an SBS point of view. Are you the only network that's really deployed people on this story in this way, or would we have seen a revolving door of radio and TV people from the ABC through there as well?
Look, I was joined by a colleague from the ABC on the ground, but speaking personally here for one moment and as someone who's covered Egypt extensively, I would have liked to have seen a lot more Australian faces in that courtroom if it was me locked in a cage wearing a white jumpsuit for simply doing my job over there. And as a result of this story and today's global action, there seems to be a lot more interest in Australia in this story, and I'm very pleased about that. But look, we were very keen to explore this story, but of course the challenge is, how do you do that? You know, this is my 12th, 13th trip to Egypt in recent years, and it's incredibly difficult, almost impossible to operate. There is a law in Egypt that says you can be arrested for using a camera. So for me to go there and tell this story was very difficult. However, the family allowed us to travel with their representative, and we had to operate very cautiously, but we were able to tell that story. And the conditions in which he's being treated seem to be in contradiction with Egyptian law. He's only being allowed out to exercise once a day for 1 hour, entitled to have 4 hours of exercise. He's not being allowed any books, reading material, writing material, no access to newspapers or television. When he went to court, he had no translator. That was refused. He has not seen any of the prosecution evidence case against him in order to prepare his own defense. So there are some serious questions being asked about how this prosecution is being handled by the Egyptian authorities.
Yeah, Zainab, we've talked about Egypt's lack of international self-awareness from time to time. When you look at something like this, and I was raising the question, you know, if you are sitting in D.C. or I'm saying if you're an Egyptian diplomat sitting in D.C., or any number of capitals around the world, do you not think that there have to be cables going back saying this is just playing out so badly, we really need to sort this out, or not, because there are bigger issues to deal with potentially?
I suspect everybody has their head down as much as they possibly can, given the turmoil that's taking place in Egypt. But I think what's interesting and actually quite disturbing about this is kind of if I can kind of go up to 30,000 feet. You know, you look at the National Intelligence Council in the US, their Global Trends 2030 report. You look at a similar report that came out last year here in Europe, and they all talk about empowerment of the individual as being one of the big trends that's going to take place over the coming decades. This, to me, is a great manifestation of the incredible fear that a state has towards an individual, or in this case, four individuals that have been arrested to go along with, I think, a couple who are already, if not more, who are sitting in jails. The idea of the incredible power that a journalist has, that has to be held back, that idea that I think didn't exist in quite the same way. I mean, yes, there's always been security issues for journalists, but there's an incredible idea there that I think is, you know, and your ability to go out there, Brett, also says the power of the individual, the power of journalism to affect change.
Brett, is there any way for international listeners to pick up more on this report, or is SBS largely blocked unless you're living within Australia? Because we're going to have to probably leave it here shortly.
No, you can look on the SBS Dateline website or our Twitter account, which is Dateline SBS, and you can find the link there. But I would say the hashtag Free AJ Staff has been had more than 415 million individual hits on Twitter since this has started. So there is a huge global campaign to free not only Peter Gresta, who of course is an Australian, but also his Egyptian colleagues who we have to fight for too, because they're going to find it very difficult to get out of prison.
Brett Mason from SBS World News, a correspondent based here in London, and Zainab Dormandy from Chatham House. Very good to see both of you. You're listening to Midori House. Back after this.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Mônaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Mônaco 24.
Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London,
Londres.
Isto é Mônaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai a Mônaco, vai a City Chase.
From London,
London, London, cara.
De Londres, de Londres.
This is we're slightly adrift of the bottom of the hour. It's just coming up to 33 minutes past, but I can tell you there's still plenty to come. Over the next 27 minutes, we'll be checking with one of our correspondents. We'll also review some books topping the bestseller list in Italy. We'll bring you a bit of music too, or maybe not. But first, Mr. Paul Osborne is back with the bottom of the hour headlines.
The interim government has taken charge in Ukraine and warned Russia to avoid any acts of aggression in Crimea. Earlier, armed men seized the regional parliament there. It's the only part of Ukraine that has a majority Russian population. Russia, meanwhile, has continued military exercises close to the border with Ukraine for a second day. A series of bomb attacks in the Iraqi capital Baghdad are believed to have killed at least 31 people. 17 died in a single explosion at a market. A second bomb was attached to a minibus, killing five more. More than 50 others have been injured. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has said she will work with Britain to reform the way the European Union works, but has warned that it won't be an easy task. She was speaking after talks in London with David Cameron, who has called for significant changes to the EU and says he'll hold a referendum in Britain in 3 years' time on whether the country should remain a member. Islamist militants have been blamed for attacks in the northeast of Nigeria, in which at least 28 people have been killed. Shops, houses and banks were looted and set on fire in a six-hour raid by members of Boko Haram. The attack came as the French president joined African leaders at a conference on security in the Nigerian capital. And protests have been staged in cities around the world demanding the release of 9 journalists from the Al Jazeera network who are detained in Egypt. They went on trial last week, accused of aiding a terrorist organization, the Muslim Brotherhood, which was banned by Egypt's military rulers. They're among a total of 20 who are facing what Al Jazeera has called absurd and false allegations. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Paul Osborne, thanks very much. And more from you at the top of the hour. Now time to, of course, jump across this continent and go and talk to one of our correspondents. It just happens that our Sophie Grove, our business editor, who's also based out in Istanbul, is here closing the issue. But fortunately, our Joseph Dana, our Eastern Mediterranean correspondent, is manning the fort. Hello, Joseph.
Good evening, Tyler.
Now, I guess we should probably start with a story which is, it's one of those stories that if you're in leadership, it doesn't go away. And this is this tape, which has come to light. I love the concept of just something being a tape these days as well, not just a recording. I have this sort of image of a sort of a small cassette tape sort of doing its ways around the souks and markets of Istanbul. But it's basically the PM, as we're told, telling his son Bilal to go and stash 30 million euros away. So the evolution of the story, and where does it stand right now, Joseph?
Well, this has really just been the kind of pinnacle of this this last couple of months of massive corruption scandal that's been rocking Turkey. And it's really starting to turn some heads. I mean, we saw in the New York Times today, the New York Times led with a very detailed piece about what's going on in Turkey above the fold. And so the Americans are clearly talking about what's happening here. And in addition to the tape of Erdogan speaking to his son, or allegedly speaking to his son about stashing something like 30 million euros in cash, a new tape came out late last night about some bribes. Again, Erdogan speaking to his son, saying, you know, we have to kind of get this money into the necessary hands. Now, what's very interesting about this whole story to me is the fact that anyone that's really been in Turkey for a long period of time knows that the Turkish government taps phones. I mean, it's not a big secret. This is kind of a thing that they do here. And so the idea that a cassette tape or a tape, a recording of the prime minister having a phone conversation, an unsecured phone conversation with his son, you know, concerning millions of euros in cash, just seems a little far-fetched to me. And so I think what's at play here is that there's definitely some sort of tape that has surfaced. It might be a little bit embellished, but, you know, it's gotten to this kind of fever pitch, and we're only going to see more of this until the local elections in Istanbul and across the country at the end of March.
How does this play out across the networks? In Turkey, of course, you have rolling news channels like anywhere else, and then obviously a series of other broadcasters. And of course, I imagine also, you know, amongst those networks, people, you know, pushing or not at various levels for the government. Is this, you know, topping, you know, all headlines, or is it sort of an item 2, 3, 4, 5 number for other networks?
It's definitely topping all headlines. I mean, the corruption scandal that's really rocking this country is everywhere. And the interesting thing about the Turkish media is that it is so partisan. I mean, you really have newspapers that are clearly aligned with one political party or one political faction. The kind of silver lining in all of this is the fact that a number of journalists have been let go because of their political stances over the past 8 months, and they've actually kind of created an independent, or at least as independent of a media kind of atmosphere as they can. And so there's one website called T24, which is a collection of a number of these journalists that used to be in the major publications that have kind of pulled together. And they're really just kind of running wild with all of these tapes. And like I said, it's really kind of the most recent pinnacle of this corruption scandal. And so, you know, every day there's kind of new revelations. And so tomorrow might bring another tape, or maybe there's a lot of rumors about possibly a sex tape. And so this does move newspapers, and it's just consuming the Turkish political atmosphere.
And speaking on a political footing as well, and quite literally, football clubs, and of course, clearly, anyone who, of course, follows football and certainly looking at Istanbul, Obviously, sort of rather fiery affairs, but also the, you know, the brand name and the brand recognition that Turkish clubs have built up is quite extraordinary. But I guess the step beyond that, just the dollar value that they might have from sponsorship, is also the political power as well.
Absolutely. The, you know, the intersection between football and politics is very common in all over the world, especially in South America. And here in Turkey, it's gone to kind of fever pitch, to use a bad pun, I suppose. But basically, during the Gezi Park protest last summer, one of the supporter clubs of Beşiktaş, which is one of the local Istanbul teams on the European side, really took an almost political position during these protests and led a lot of these protests. They were on the streets, you know, literally battling with the police, and they really kind of captured the hearts and minds of a number of the younger leftists that were on the streets. And so now we have another club that's on the Asian side of Istanbul called Fenerbahçe, which was involved in a very big match-fixing scandal, and their chairman, Aziz Yıldırım, has actually been indicted along with 92 other people in this match-fixing saga, and he has come out and said that this is not about football, that this is about politics. Effectively, he said that the Gulanists, the followers of the self-imposed Muslim cleric in Pennsylvania, who's been really at the heart of this corruption probe with Erdogan, who has deep influence inside of the judiciary and inside of the police, he said that the Gulanists are trying to manipulate this verdict and basically put him in jail and silence him because of the supporters of Fenerbahçe. We're talking about millions of people that love this club and that will take to the streets if they're told. And so we see that this corruption scandal and the politics in this country has really bled into all aspects of life, whether it's cultural or whether it's sport.
Just on that notion of manipulation, I want to just end on something you've sent along, which is a significant takeover of a major player in the agricultural and certainly food business in the country, and this is an acquisition of a major dairy group by a major player from the Gulf, it turns out. So the essence of this story, Joseph, we see all over the world issues of scarcity with food, but also food security. So is this also, you know, a little bit of a tale that here you've got a major player out of the Gulf, really sort of trying to just buy up supply in another country because they have nothing in their own backyard?
It is that tale, and it's actually a very positive tale. I mean, the news coming from Turkey, especially in the economic sector, has been quite melancholy of late. And yet, we have this growing Turkish agribusiness industry. Effectively, Turkey has an incredible wealth of food. It's got a very varied climate. It's got a huge territory. It's got a lot of water. It has exactly what the Persian Gulf and other countries in the Horn of Africa don't have, and it also has food that's produced in line with Muslim dietary laws. And so we see an industry that really could expand and that could allow Turkey to become that kind of energy exporter that it wants to be. It's geographically positioned perfectly to export natural gas, to export oil, to export all of these different energy commodities. And the only one that it actually has growing in its backyard, as it were, is food. And so we see the Gulf companies moving in quickly, taking massive stakes in some of the dairy and meat companies in Turkey. And this is really, I think, one of the industries to watch, especially during this political crisis, because it's really what Turkey can offer the international markets and really grow its export base, as it were.
Joseph Dana, our Eastern Mediterranean correspondent in Istanbul. We're going to have to leave it there. Going away for a short break. When we get back, we're going to jump across the Atlantic and have a bit of a tour of New York's public library.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Studio One here at Midori House with me, Tyler Berlay. Just 1843 here in London. It's 13 43 in New York, where we head to now. For many of New York City's high-minded cultural institutions, the city's new boss is somewhat of a mystery. While Mayor Mike Bloomberg marched into his office with a thick Rolodex of names and connections to the cultural elite, that's not the case with his successor, Bill de Blasio. As my next guest says, de Blasio remains something of a mystery, but this doesn't mean the mayor is avoiding controversy on the cultural front. Before he came into office, de Blasio said that Mayor Bloomberg should stop giving money to a renovation of the Fifth Avenue location of the New York Public Library until they figured out how much it will cost. But now that de Blasio is mayor, things aren't so simple. For the committee to save the New York Public Library, the old line, meet the new boss, same as the old boss, has a particular resonance right now. Well, to talk us through the controversy, we're joined from our New York bureau by Robin Pogorban, culture reporter for the New York Times. Good afternoon.
Hi, nice to be here.
So is this a classic backpedal that certainly as the committee to save the public library, they're certainly positioning it that way. And I guess from your desk's perspective at the New York Times, did you all sort of see this coming anyway?
I think, you know, Bill de Blasio, as far as culture is concerned, the jury is out. And I think cultural institutions across the city are understandably nervous as a result, particularly since he comes on the heels of his predecessor, who was very highly connected. Michael Bloomberg was not only a huge supporter of the arts and very vocal about it, but he put his own money where his mouth was and gave privately. He used to serve on the board of Lincoln Center. He was very much entrenched and had real personal relationships with some of the leadership of these institutions. Bill de Blasio is an unknown in this regard. He's much more kind of has grassroots ties, certainly very strong in Brooklyn. And I think it remains to be seen what he's like on the cultural front. And given that he's talked about other priorities like pre-kindergarten schooling and affordable housing, it's just not clear that the arts is at the top of his list.
Mm. I mean, for those listeners not sitting on the North American East Coast, during the campaign period, I'm wondering, was culture much of a discussion, and how much did it come up, or was it really, you know, obviously, you know, the bigger discussion about, you know, the have-nots and the top percent of certainly the socioeconomic scale? I mean, that seemed to be the debate that we saw elsewhere.
Yes, and actually, it's a very good question because culture generally doesn't rise to the top of anyone's agenda in terms of debate or an election. And that's true nationally. The NEA doesn't come up much, and it's certainly true locally, particularly when de Blasio's emphasis is on kind of trying to create a more egalitarian city. And, you know, arguably, the city's cultural institutions are sort of the cream of the crop, and they are sort of populated by some of our more well-off citizens, and in large part these institutions depend on their largesse, and it's important for the mayor to cultivate them and keep them generous. So that's something that matters. And clearly, culture, I mean, it's considered the cultural capital of the world by a lot of people, so it matters and it generates a lot of economic activity. So I think it's going to matter. You know, it just hasn't been that high on the agenda, and understandably so. So I think in terms of the library, the mayor probably just hasn't really gotten around to focusing on it yet. He did speak out about it when he was public advocate, but I think right now it just sort of hasn't been high on the list, and people are kind of waiting to see what happens in that regard, particularly because he hasn't appointed a cultural affairs commissioner, and then the previous mayor had done so by January.
Mm. Walk us through the public library, $150 million, I guess, already earmarked by the Bloomberg administration, but obviously an estimate, some saying $300 million, some saying it could be up to, you know, $500 million that's required. Is it urgent, those funds?
Well, you know, it's a really tough question because, you know, there was a time when almost every cultural institution seemed to be adding a wing or expanding or renovating, and it was kind of the era of the Stark Architect, and there was a lot of money going around. We've since had a recession and a lot of retrenchment, and I think that as a result, these kinds of projects get a lot more scrutiny in terms of whether they're necessary and certainly whether they deserve public funds. And $150 million from the city is clearly quite a lot of money. The city has long supported the library and its operations, but this is capital money. This is capital funds for a building project. And the $150 million was earmarked specifically for this proposal, which is to, you know, take this flagship 42nd Street Library, which everyone knows it's guarded by the Lions. It's really the headquarters. And right now it's a research library where you can't take books out. You cannot borrow them. You have to use them there. Across the street is the Mid-Manhattan Library, which has been there, you know, for a long time, is very run down and clearly needs an upgrade, but is like one of the most used libraries in the city for circulation. People can take books out there. They also can, you know, spend the whole day, and many of them do. The idea is to fold the operations of the Mid-Manhattan into the 42nd Street flagship, making it both a research and circulating library, and using the space in order to do that where stacks for books are currently housed. Actually, a lot of the books have been removed already, if not all of them. The stacks are considered antiquated and not appropriate in terms of climate control. And so the library is proposing to use that space with a design by the British architect Norman Foster to turn that into a circulating library within the research library. And that proposal has been very controversial. One, because it involved removing books and moving them off site. That's a question that's still not entirely resolved. But it also involves, you know, spending $150 million of the city's money and then raising a good deal more from private funds in order to make that project happen. And a lot of people feel that that money could be used better elsewhere, towards the 88 branches all over the city, some of which are in, you know, disrepair, and also to maybe just renovate Mid-Manhattan, which could be economically make more sense. Mm.
Robin, just before we go, one thing we've noticed, revolving doors of administrations, it's certainly a case that New York likes to appoint various czars when there's a problem. So we've seen education czars and crime czars. Is there hope that at least Mayor de Blasio decide and name a bit of a culture czar? And are there any names on the horizon?
You know, there's been a lot of names kicked around, and he had a transition committee in the arts where that was comprised of many people in the arts world who made recommendations to him. I don't know that any of those names has actually kind of solidified as a strong choice. Kate Levin, who had the job of commissioner before, was well respected and liked. She was kind of out in New York all the time seeing everything, and I think was considered a real strong advocate for culture. But she was also kind of doing the mayor's bidding to the extent that, you know, Mayor Bloomberg set the tone that culture mattered. Whether or not de Blasio does that remains to be seen, and I think everyone's, you know, very eager for a verdict on that score.
Robin Pogerman for the New York Times in our New York Bureau. Thanks very much for joining us. We're going away for a short break, a bit of an Italian theme to wind up the show right after this. Well, if it's 1851 in London, it's time for a song, I believe. The 2014 winner of Italy's annual Sanremo Music Festival, which happened, of course, it's been the inspiration for the Eurovision Song Contest, I should say. We should hear who, of course, grabbed the prize. This is Arisa with Contravento. Arisa there with Contravento, winner of the San Remo Festival this year, which of course leads us nicely as we're staying in Italy. Time for a review segment today, and it's for your sort of packing yourself off for bedtime, and you managed to, of course, read Italian, and then you might want a few book tips. And fortunately, we're joined by our Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho. Hello, Ivan.
Good evening, Tyler.
So tell us, we've got, you've given actually, you know, quite a stack here, but in the interest of just having about 4 minutes left, what are you going to send us off to bed with?
Okay, real quick, Ammazziamo il Gatto Pardo is a book written by Alan Friedman. He's a U.S. journalist based in Italy, and it's interesting commentary. He talked with various former prime ministers, and it's just come out, and an excerpt was released beforehand, and it's been stirring up a lot of controversy because there's mention in the book that Mario Monti, who speaks with Alan Friedman in the book, about Napolitano talking with Monti before Berlusconi's government fell in the summer, so 3 or 4 months ahead of time. So people are saying that Napolitano was maybe planning ahead for some possible coup or ouster. So there's a bit of controversy, especially from the Berlusconi camp, saying that Napolitano is undermining Berlusconi. So there you have it.
Okay, so that's a bit of heavy reading pre-bedtime. What next?
We have something a bit lighter, sort of Clash of Generations. The Striati by Michele Sera, who's a writer, and he is sort of a monologue essay commentary about his adolescent son. There's a lot of these books coming out, I don't know why, like sort of a parenting boom about the crisis with dealing with adolescent teenagers in Italy. It's sort of a bit, I have to say, from my perspective, it's kind of, he's a bit lamenting on this young generation. I don't think he's too fair on his son, saying these people are a bit lazy and the, you know, with the technology and the smartphones, and it's caught also a bit of controversy. I'm not too convinced on his argument about this, and people saying that, you know, young people don't have a lot of opportunities in Italy because the old people hold on to power. So
And has it become a bit of a manifesto piece, and where is it sitting in the certainly in the nonfiction rankings?
Well, it was up there, but Alan Friedman's book just booted it out of the number one spot in the top 10. So obviously politics is very important right now because of, you know, the new government with Renzi coming in. So but it was up there for a while. It came out the end of the last year, so It's, again, a hot topic.
Now, in our current issue, there was a lot of attention, at least a good spread, given to the prowess of good Italian graphic design. And something out of that territory is also doing quite well on the charts, isn't it?
Yeah, this is something I took out. Sort of an independent publisher, Coraini, put out a book, the autobiography of Italo Lupi, a graphic designer, maybe not many people know, maybe perhaps abroad, but he, for example, did the graphic design for the look for the Turin Olympics in 2006, was art director of Domus magazine, the well-known Italian architecture magazine. And it's a nice, again, very unconventional, because Coraini, as a publisher, is very unconventional. So there's not like a retrospective from A to Z with essays. It's from sort of all over the place. With Lupi talking about inspiration. So it's not just his work, but he taking magazine covers, images from books, and illustrations that he finds inspiring. And so it's a good sort of map of his sort of thinking and on how he approaches graphic design.
Ivan Carvalho, our man in Milan. We're going to have to leave it there. Have a very good evening. That's all the time we have for today's edition of Midori House. Big thanks to our guests earlier in the program, Brett Mason, of course, of Australian Network SBS, and Xenia Dormady from Chatham House. Today's show is produced by Thomas Lewis, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Michaela Aitken, and our studio manager is Chris Chilvers. Next up is The Urbanist, where Andrew Tuck takes a look at city guides, from the well-traveled blue guidebooks to the people soundscaping their way around Vancouver, plus the man who's been showing tourists around New York for over 30 years.
I think visiting a city, no matter where you are, the key thing is that cities are made of people. And without people, what is the point of the experience?
That's The Urbanist up next at 2200. The Monocle Daily is here with Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson. And this show is back at 1800 tomorrow. But for me, Tyler Brulé, and all of the team, have a very good evening. Goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.